Welcome to a ThinkWorks special. Today, we're opening the long boxes, dusting off the well-thumbed adventures, and stepping into worlds where impossible heroes, fearless explorers, vigilantes, and legendary warriors have captured imaginations for generations. Join your hosts, Darren Smithson and Chris Dingsdale, as they journey through the golden age of comics, newspaper strips, and adventure fiction, rediscovering forgotten worlds, timeless characters, remarkable creators, favorite memories, and the stories that shape the lifetime of imagination. So, pull up a chair, turn the page, and prepare for adventure.
Barzumian knights were always harsh and unforgiving. My breath turned to ice before my eyes, before the crystals fell to the planet's surface. I drew my white ape hide overcoat closer around me and simultaneously checked my air pistol to make sure there was one in the chamber, in case events took a dangerous turn. Having four arms can be useful sometimes. I tried to pull my hat down a little, but my lower canines got in the way as usual. Oh well. Behind me, the oxygen factories pumped out life-giving atmosphere, and the great city of Helium stood before me, all imposing structures and gleaming spires. But opulence wasn't to be my destination this evening. No, I was heading for the back alleys, the dens of iniquity on the dark side of the great Martian city. Just another typical evening in the life of Mike Tarkas, Barzumian private eye. Tarkas Bar was run by my hive brother Tars. He had given up a life of adventuring to retire and sell that fine Barzumian ale to all and anyone who could afford the tariff. He tells me that he occasionally gets the rare chance to offer strange alien drinks left by the odd traveler. He talks about whiskey, bourbon, and something called vodka. I even tried some once way back, tasted good, but left with one hive mother of a headache. I walked towards the old Barzumian red mudstone building. Tar's name lit up over the door. The parking lot was sure busy tonight. Small Helium airships were flanked by a couple of Baroque steel and glass spaceships. Earth origin at a guess, I marveled at how they would have made the long trip with just a few small rocket engines and those little tail fins. A Barzumian, though, was tethered to the door. The double saddle suggested John and his princess were inside. Always my pleasure to see them, especially the incomparable Deja Thoris. The biggest surprise was the rolled-up carpet propped up against the bar door. The old man was inside the dawn. Gullivar himself. Something big was definitely coming down. I pushed through the door into the chaos. The sound and smell of a dozen differing beings hit me at once. Tars waved a spare arm at me. the other serving drinks and taking credit simultaneously. As I pass through the dark room towards the bar, I look down at an imposing blonde human flanked by two beautiful females. One looked fresh and wholesome, the other lithe and dark with mischief in her eyes. He was talking to another human traveler and his female companion, both wearing metal helmets, odd old-fashioned weapons hanging from their belts. Their conversation, as far as I could translate, concentrated on their adversaries. I caught the names Ming and Killer Kane as I passed. I made a mental note to be cautious should I ever run into them at some point. Taz pushed the glass of ale into one of my four hands as I reached the bar. "You ready for this, Mike?" he asked. "Sure," I said, opening my coat and patting my air pistol reassuringly. Taz nodded before replying, "This could get nasty, Mike. I need you riding air shotgun on this one." Taz jumped onto the bar and waved his forearms furiously at the assembled crowd. "Right attention, everyone," he shouted. "It's time to settle this argument once and for all." He paused to get the patron's silent attention and said softly, "Now, exactly who was the first?"
Welcome back, Chris.
Welcome, Darren. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, and last time we talked about the pulp heroes that inspired like the superheroes of today, but we left out a couple of really big areas, and we said we'd come back and visit them, and that's the idea of these and sandal and the space adventure heroes and all that kind of stuff, and the interplanetary romance, because one of the things that fascinated me was how much romance was actually the core part of some of those early science fiction heroes. But we'll come on to that. But one of the things that we said we really would talk about was probably, aside from Conan, the biggest impactful creation of all, and that's Tarzan.
Tarzan, yeah. I mean, you know, a character you can't even overstate his impact on popular culture. Probably recognizable to most of the world, I would imagine, even today. So created by Gryce Burroughs, all the way back in 1912, the October issue started to serialize its story. I don't think we need to recap Tarzan's history, do we? I mean, he was.
I think, even if we've got a visitor from Mars listening, they probably know.
He probably knows who he is. He probably knows he is. John Clayton, the Viscount Greystoke, his parents were marooned in, you know, what we. He's probably the Congo rainforest where he was brought up by gorillas, by apes. I first read this, I don't know about you, I first read this in a Bantam paperback brought back by my cousin from the US, and it has a Neil Adams cover. That Neil Adams cover would have made you want to read anything.
Yeah, let alone. That's true.
Fantastic. I mean, it's just a fantastic cover. And I don't know the last time you read the story, I've read it a couple of times, but it's got an amazing last paragraph. Which is so impactful. I mean, an absolute work of genius. But there you go. I mean, Burroughs followed up with 24 books. He was pretty successful. Did you know when he was actually in Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked in Hawaii? And following that event, he actually applied to the U.S. State Department to be a war correspondent. He was the oldest war correspondent. He was 61 when Pearl Harbor was attacked. And I think for a while, I'm not mistaken, for a while he was the journalist, the war correspondent who was furthest out in the Pacific with the US forces.
Wow. So, at 61.
But again, you know, we go back to the what we were talking about, the previous heroes, where sometimes the creators actually mirrored their characters. You know, potentially here's another one. Incredibly successful. I mean, you know, there's a town called Tarzana in California. where he had his ranch. I mean, you could do several podcasts on Tarzan, couldn't you? Movies, yeah. Radio, film, TV.
Yeah.
The great Ron Ealy, connection to Doc Savage, the TV
yeah.
show.
Yeah. And my first encounter with Tarzan was the BBC Two Saturday Matinee movies with Johnny Weissmuller.
Oh yeah.
And so that's how I discovered Tarzan. And I think it was it DC Comics in the 70s? They had a Tarzan.
Yeah,
comic.
Great run with Joe Kubert. It was really became associated with a character.
Yeah, so I came into Tarzan from the other media that obviously came out of the original stories. And then I think it was many years later before I actually picked up that Tarzan novel.
Yeah.
And I think, if I remember correctly, this is a long time ago, I actually had a collection of Edgar Rice Burroughs novels in an omnibus, which has since been lost somewhere. I don't know where it got lost, but it's got lost.
Yeah. 24. I think I've read all 24. By the last one, he's actually, you know, it's World War II and he's in the RAF, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Do remember, and he crashes on an island. I don't know where to start with Tarzan. I mean, there are some new novels. We should mention Will Murray again, who's done the Wild Adventures novels and has done a crossover with Tarzan and a character we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah,
there's that great, really sort of left field Tarzan Alive by Philip Jose Farmer. I don't know if you've ever read it.
No, I've read that.
Biography. Fantastic. It's so good, you would actually think it's fact.
Yeah.
Well worth reading. And of course, and Phil Jose Farmer also did the same thing for Doc Savage, His Apocalyptic Life. So there's a ton of stuff here. There's so much scholarly stuff been written.
Yeah.
Massive, you know, huge presence in comics, pretty much an ongoing presence in newspaper strips for the best part of 100 years, I think. Foster, Burton, Garth, crikey, Joe Kubert. John Buscema, Gil Kane, Mike Grell, Russ Manning, you know, it's a who's who, Neil Adams with those covers, it's a complete who's who. But
I mean, his impact, it cannot be overstated, his impact.
No, because I mean, every jungle
hero that followed, the DNA is directly from Tarzan. Khazar or whatever. Khazar's origin, you might as well have just called him Tarzan anyway, because the origin is exactly the same. You know,
the lawyers prevented it. Yeah. I love Kazar stories, actually. But you can't overstate his impact on popular culture. He must be one of the most ubiquitous characters on the planet, I would think.
Yeah. I think if you said Tarzan to anyone, they'd instantly go, jungle man, raised by apes, loincloth.
Correct. Yeah.
And they know, even if they've never read or seen any TV program or any film or any book or any comic, they would be able to say what Tarzan is and looks like.
Yeah. The only comic I'd have to say about movies is, having read the books, you may agree or disagree. I don't think he's not frequently been accurately portrayed in the movies because he's an intelligent guy in the books.
Yeah.
And the movies don't often portray him that way. I mean, a couple have, and then they've tried it different ways, haven't they? I mean, there was a couple of films with Mike Henry, I think, in the 60s when the spy craze was going, and it was almost like a secret agent or something.
Do you know, I haven't seen them. I'll have to check them out.
Yeah, Mike Henry was a former footballer. Mike Henry apparently was close to playing Batman in the TV series in the 60s.
Wow.
I don't know, did that ever happen? I'm not sure.
No.
But yeah, Mike Henry nearly played Batman. So, and then there was the film, I think about 10 years ago, with Alexander Skarsgård. I quite like that because it took a different approach. Started off with him in London and going back to the jungle. But I think that kind of leads us into our main topic, really, which is the what we're going to call it. We're going to call it Sword and Star. We're going to call it Planetary Romance.
I think they very much started off as Planetary Romance stories. It's really weird if you look at the thread that went through them. It seemed to always be, not always, but the motif that was most commonly used was Earthman somehow transports to other planet, and there's always a princess. And they form a romantic relationship. That seems to be the kind of template. Or a princess from another planet on the run lands on Earth and ends up taking
refuge.
That's
quite common, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's every man's fantasy, isn't it? Just, you know. Yeah. I have to put myself out there. It's just, you know, vulnerability, all that stuff. Anyway, so we have this kind of duality going on, but gradually they became so much more. If you look at, I know we're going to talk about him now, and that's John Carter. Yeah. I mean, that was world building on an epic scale.
Absolutely. Oh, well, let's flick into that. And so it's our guy, Edgar Rice Burroughs, who we've just talked about. Obviously, had many good ideas in his life and created.
Yes.
So just before the Tarzan story was serialized in Old Story magazine, February to July 1912, A Princess of Mars was serialized. Yes. John Carter. And it's not just that simple. I mean, I think the great thing about John Carter is when you read the first novel, Princess of Mars, he's already this kind of immortal hero, which is suggested that he's lived many lifetimes, et cetera, et cetera. And he winds up on Mars. Doing a little bit of research this, Mars was a popular concept at this time in popular fiction. There was an astronomer called Percival Lowell
who wrote a book. Canals of Mars.
Mars, that's right, where he talked about Mars had been an Earth-like planet which had long since died, and obviously with telescopes you could see the what were termed to be the Martian canals. So it's an easy connection to make. That came out in 1895, I think, the book.
Yeah, something like that.
And then I suppose that's a little bit like Egyptianism in the 1920s after Howard Carter discovered Tutankhamun, you know.
Yeah.
Popular culture became fairly fascinated with it. And then you've got, I suppose if you tip that back a little bit, you know, H.G. Wells wrote War of the Worlds in 1898. So, you know, Martians in the kind of the, you know, it's in, the, what is it, word, the zeitgeist, public psyche?
I think so.
So John Carter sort of flicks into that, even though there are a couple of heroes before him. But like you say, amazing world building. Mars becomes the world of Barsoom. There's some great ideas, like the place hasn't got an atmosphere, but there are atmosphere factories which generate, you know, a life preserving atmosphere. 11 books. I don't think I've read them all. I've read about six, I think. I don't know about you. Read all?
No, I think I've read the first four. But again, a long time ago.
Me too. Obviously he meets the alluring princess Dejah Thoris.
The incomparable.
Incomparable, Dejah Thoris. Now, this always interested me, right? So if I recall right, the Martians they're oviparous, aren't they? So they're born, well, you know, there's a couple of bits of female anatomy they don't need, I would have thought, that point. So, hell, why, you know, why let facts get in the way of a good story, right?
Yeah.
And some great visual imagery. But it's A Princess of Mars is a great novel. It's got some great imagery. It's got some great action. It keeps moving all the time. It's extremely exciting. And as I say, it spawned a series and obviously caught the public's imagination. I mean, John Carter hasn't been as prevalent in the popular media since, unfortunately. So the comics have been a lesser, I think.
Think
history.
Yeah, I mean, I very excited. John Carter, the Marvel comic.
I enjoyed that. Yeah, great.
I thought that was great, and it had fantastic artwork from Mike Vosburgh as well. We have to give him a shout out for the later issues. But I'd already read, obviously, John Carter. I'd already read the first four novels a long time even before the comic series started. Okay. So I was really excited, and it was out at the time when finally you could get American US comics quite easily or relatively easily compared to what it used to be like. It was just at that right time, so it was the nice sweet spot, and I was blown away. I thought that comic series was actually really, really good, a lot better. Mm-hmm. It's one of those you have to read it in bulk, read a single issue at a time. It kind of wouldn't, but if you read it in bulk, it's like wow, because it did capture a lot of the threads that Burroughs had tried to put in.
Yes.
Across
yeah,
the
it was, I mean, it was great. I think Marv Wolfman started it off, didn't he? And then Chris Claremont yeah. took it. But it was clearly written by people who cared about the source material. Yeah. Some great artists. Yeah. Didn't it start off with like Gil Kane and Dave Cockrum?
Yeah.
And then went to others like, say, Mike. I'm not mistaken, was Frank Miller's first Marvel work in John Carter?
Oh.
Either a cover or one issue. I might be wrong.
I think there was work on a cover, wasn't there? I know his first comic was in Daredevil, his first full one he drew.
I'm pretty sure
it was Daredevil, but you're right. The comic struggled to find because people didn't know who John Carter was. That was the problem. And so it always struggled. I think it almost got cancelled about five times in its history.
Oh, really?
And then Marvel were obviously going through a lot of issues as well financially, as we know in that period now. And the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate, if I remember correctly, wanted more money than Marvel could afford, which is ultimately what brought the comic to an end. Which is a real shame because I just thought it was a great comic.
It was terrific. I mean, it's terrific. It's a terrific series, I think. Some great creators, really enjoyable. Mm. But I think that, I mean, it's that lack of, whereas you could say Tarzan, and everybody knows who he is. John Carter, probably not many people know who he is, really.
No.
And when they did get around to a movie in 2012, still nobody knew who he was, unfortunately.
No, because they didn't attach the magic word to the title.
Correct, of Mars or Warlock. Mars.
Yeah, why?
Yeah,
it still beggars belief to me.
Yeah, although there's a book out there called John Carter and the Gods of Hollywood, which is well worth a read about that movie and how apparently the studio literally ditched it to satisfy themselves so they could, promote their acquisition of Star Wars. Who knows if that's true?
Yeah.
But also, did you know that? Do you remember the John Dark, Kevin Connor? Burroughs movies of the 70s, Land of Time, etc. You know, they looked at doing John Carter.
Wow.
With Doug McClure.
The ubiquitous.
The ubiquitous Doug McClure. Yeah, the Doug show was going to be John Carter. So
wow.
I would pay to see that now, quite frankly.
Yeah, I would too.
But
some of my favourite movies from that era, with Doug in it, at the Earth's Core and... Yeah, it's just
Warlords of Atlantis.
Oh yeah, I've got the box set.
Yeah, I knew you would. I can do no wrong.
I'm gonna have to watch them again now.
You can't be a bit of Doug McClure. So anyway, apparently the logistics and the scope of it just defeated them. I mean, I'm not sure how you do the four-armed Martians. By the way, Do you enjoy the 2012 movie? I did.
I thought, actually. I mean, I must admit, I approached it with a certain amount of trepidation. I thought, this is either going to be really good or it's going to be awful. And I just thought, why did this movie fail? And then, for a start off, just call it... I mean, who the heck, apart from Edgar Rice Burroughs fans, would even know who John Carter was? They needed to attach Of Mars...
Correct.
Onto the title somehow. Yeah. And it just, anyway, so, but yeah. And I think it's important to point out to everyone, the reason why we spent so much time on John Carter, however, is even if you don't know who he is, you have seen him on screen and in comics and in novels ever since. He's just not called John Carter.
Yeah. The thing that always amused me when that movie came out was that a lot of the critics said, it's just ripping off Star Wars.
Yeah.
No, guys, you got this wrong.
No, Star Wars ripped off. Joking. I mean, is there in Flash Gordon? Is there in Dune?
In Buck Rogers.
Frank Herbert's, He-Man even.
Absolutely. Again, it's huge influence, but it's a shame that the name and the concept didn't sort of catch on with the public in general. I'm sure we just
see
more of
it. I think what we're saying to the listener is go and get some John Carter novels and enjoy
them. Certainly the first one. The first one's a great read. It's not particularly long, but it's a really great, exciting read. As I recall, they get a little bit thinner as they go on. I think I read the first six. But obviously John, I mean, you know more about these characters than me, but John wasn't the only protagonist of the planetary romance.
No, and And what's really interesting is I remember reading, are we talking about Gulliver Jones now?
We can talk about Gulliver or Eric John Stark or whoever, yeah.
Or John Stark, yeah. But I remember reading the comic version with Gil Kane on the art. I'm sure it was Gil Kane on the art of Gulliver Jones in one of the Marvel Weeklies.
Creatures on the Loose, I've done my research.
Creatures on the Loose was the comic, American one, but it was reprinted in one of the weeklies. I can't remember which one, probably Planet of the Apes, but it was in one of the weeklies. And I remember thinking, oh, this is just almost exactly the same as Warlord of Mars. Because, I mean, the magic carpet ride aside, it was very, very similar. And yet the DNA is from a different era completely.
Yeah, I mean, the first novel, I mean, this is great, I think. Have I written his author down? But the first novel was originally called 1905, Gulliver Jones, His Vacation.
Yes.
Which is sort of John Carter syndrome. Nobody from that title is going to know this is a science fiction novel.
No, but it was kind of like, I mean, it was, was it 1895, I think, Gulliver was was created. So John Carter, Edgar Rice Burroughs, probably or possibly.
Undoubtedly.
Because they were all trying, because these heroes at their time, they were successful.
Mm.
And so, I mean, Tarzan appeared and suddenly every one of the pulp magazines had a Jungle King type hero created. And it was the same with the Mars, as you say, the Mars stories, and all these different characters appeared. So you got Gulliver in 1895, and then the one that you just mentioned, whose name's gone completely out of my head,
Eric John Stark.
That's the one.
I know little about those. I know you're a bigger fan than me, so you can elaborate a little. But I mean, let's just say that, you know, one of the issues with all these novels is how do you get them to Mars?
Yeah.
Because the concept, you know, John Carter went into a cave, I think, didn't he? Passed out.
And and there was a interdimensional doorway.
Yeah.
It took him through time as well. It wasn't just space. It was
time. That's right. Gulliver Jones, I mean, they, you know, reverted to the old magic carpet. Let's keep it simple.
Yeah, well, it's like The First Men in the Moon by H.G. Wells. It was Cavorite.
Was that
anti-gravity device?
Something like that, yeah. So how did you get them there? That was obviously a problem which they overcame. H.G. Wells coming back the other way, they were just more technologically advanced with us. So, you know, they were like in large bullets, weren't they, or something?
Yeah.
Fired a gun or something. Boy, oh boy. Yeah. Life wasn't easy, eh?
Yeah.
But yeah, Gulliver, I mean... Is that his only comics appearance, Marvel? The only appearance?
I haven't seen him anywhere else, and I don't think I've ever seen him in any other media either.
Yeah.
Which is a real shame, because actually the comic adaptation in the Marvel comic, it romped. It was a real good old-fashioned
romp. I mean, Gil Kane was good fun. Forever, I think, wasn't it? So, I mean, great. You know, great professionals. But yeah, I mean, he found the princess, I believe.
Yeah. Whatever he went to. Yeah, always a princess.
No, and so there should be. I mean, otherwise, it's not worth going, let's be honest.
No. and then Eric John Stark, he followed in 1949. So he was probably the last of this DNA of these adventurers. But it's worth mentioning Eric because, of course, he was basically Han Solo. He was that rogue. He was that almost an anti-hero without him being an anti-hero, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. He was very roguish, very charming, always on the dodgy side of town. And you can see the DNA in him, from him into kind of like the Han Solo characters. And then obviously after Star Wars, every film had a Han Solo, every science fiction fantasy movie had a Han Solo clone, but Han Solo himself came out of some of the literary heroes that we've all forgotten about, including Eric John Stark.
To complete that circle, Lee Brackett, science fiction, worked on a draft of The Empire Strikes Back, I think, for George Lucas.
He did.
So did. Lucas must clearly, well, we know he was a fan of all these things, but he must, he, you know, he clearly made that connection himself.
Yeah, I think so. And I think if you actually got George on when he was feeling particularly honest, I think in the interview he would actually admit that Star Wars originally was a love letter to all these other creations, because there's just so much in there.
And if that's the case, a fantastic love letter to them. Let's be honest, the original.
Yeah. Which brings us neatly back to our friends Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon.
Yeah. Now we need to take these in order because one begats the other. So yes. Buck Rogers. So it was, I guess, a response to the big newspaper strip era of the time, which was huge. Because it predated the sort of comic format that we're familiar with. So Buck Rogers newspaper strip started in 1929 and it carried on till 1967. These guys had a hefty life in publication.
They did.
You know, and he's a character that clearly caught the public's eye. I mean, and again, you could say he's very derivative of John Carter, Gulliver Jones. He's, you know, he's an interplanetary hero. And I think didn't he go to wherever he was off to? Because it was a cave with some gas in or something. I'm sure that was the mechanism.
Yeah, he ends up getting frozen into suspended animation.
25th century, that's right, yeah. Yes. So, yeah, and we'll come to that in a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, this lad, you know, newspaper strip, but he then went into comics. He had a life on radio. He'd had a life in the one movie serial with Buster Crabbe, who we'll mention a bit later in connection with Flash Gordon. In 1933... the original guys wrote a novella, which was published, which retold his origins. And then I guess, 67, he probably disappeared.
Yeah.
Period of time. And then in the aftermath of Star Wars, and everybody was scrabbling for licensed properties to promote, we got the absolutely fabulous TV series with Gil Gerard, Erin Gray, boys of our age, and Pamela Hensley as Princess Ardala.
Yeah.
The pilot film was shot and it was released in theatres. Apparently, it was in profit after 2 days.
Wow. Which is something most movie makers today would absolutely... That would be the nirvana, wouldn't it?
I suspect that's probably because it was made on a TV budget. Well, so what? People obviously enjoyed it. It was in the aftermath of Star Wars. Studios were searching for their licensed properties which they could promote. But a great sort of serious, oblique, tongue-in-cheek version of it. Gil Gerard as Buck Rogers, Erin Gray as Wilma Deering, and who can forget Pamela Hensley as Princess Ardala.
Yes.
2 seasons. The second one was terrible. The first one's great.
Yeah.
And, of course, the cute robot, Tweaky.
Yeah.
Voiced by the great Mel Blanc.
Mel Blanc.
He did all the Looney Tunes voices for Warner Brothers. And not much of him seen since, really. Sporadic revivals in sort of novels and comics. But let's not leave the subject without saying the pilot movie has the absolute best science fiction disco scene in movie history.
Yes, this is true. I can remember it.
It will never be bettered. Never.
No. And the whole thing about it was, again, people getting things out of sync in their own heads about, you know, oh, Buck Rogers is a ripoff of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, no.
I mean, probably, you know, it was made because Star Wars came into.
I mean, Battlestar Galactica was a ripoff of Star Wars.
Thank you.
You can say that. Buck Rogers came first. Not the series, but he came first.
But it was great. I mean, it had that great sense of fun. There was a kind of, it was science fiction. There was a little bit of James Bond in there everywhere. It had a beautiful guest star of the week as well as the ladies who were on the show. Yeah. I couldn't miss. I mean, it really couldn't miss. Tremendous fun. Yeah. Just say Gil Gerard
ruined it
recently, didn't he? Sadly.
He did. And I think the travesty is how they ruined it in that second season.
Yeah. Nobody remembers the second season. They have some silly cruise ship or something.
They're on a quest to find a cure for something, I think.
Oh, well, whatever.
Memory serves.
But do you know what? I think that TV series and associated imagery is so strong. I think that's really why, you know, it's difficult to relaunch the character. It did for Buck, I suspect, what maybe the Batman TV series did in the 60s until Tim Burton's Batman came along and reset the whole thing.
Yeah.
But fantastic. I mean, you can, you know, you can get it on streaming, you can buy it on Blu-ray and DVD. I mean, it's worth what it worth. Just watch the pilot movie until you get to the disco scene, you know.
Yeah.
You can't lose.
It's worth it for that.
You can't lose.
And then, of course, we can't really talk about Buck without Flash Gordon.
Flash Gordon, yeah. So Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon was created as a reaction to Buck Rogers, which was hugely successful.
Yeah.
The big secret here is they got King Features, who had actually tried to get the rights to John Carter for a new strip, but failed. But they employed the creator, Alex Raymond, to draw it. Alex Raymond was a fabulous, fine artist. There's lots of, I mean, and he went on to do other newspaper strips, but also illustrations, paintings. There's a couple of nice books of his artwork. He died tragically in a car crash, I think, fairly young. But the strip was taken on by further fine artists, like I think Austin Briggs, Dan Barry.
Yeah.
In later years. It's actually recently been revived. Dan Schnapke, I think, is the writer-artist for King Features. If you go on their website, you can read it for free.
Right.
But what a great character. Again, one of these, and again, he's the derivative, but he's the guy who captured the public imagination. So it's interesting.
Yeah, because he became much bigger
and always has
almost
been.
Instantly than Buck ever was.
So he captured the public... You know, he captured the public imagination in a big way. Radio, three movie serials starring the great Buster Crabbe. The first one, which is terrific because it naively, literally tries to recreate the comic.
Yeah.
Without either the budget or the technology. It's such a great effort. Apparently, George Lucas has had the original negative restored of the first serial, and it's been shown twice, I think, once in California, once in New York.
Right.
If anybody's listening out there, can you please release this damn thing on Blu-ray so I can watch it and the rest of the world can? I'd love to see that in a restored version.
Yeah, I mean, and I think as well, they're crying out for it, basically. And it's this, especially when you think, again, you come back to the fact that the movie studios, comic book publishers in particular, they owe a lot of their success.
Yes.
To these pioneering characters that came first. Yeah. And it's never going to happen because, of course, it's all about the mighty dollar. But I think both the comic book publishers and the movie studios really have a moral duty to, as you say, get those masters, remastered editions of these original.
And put them out there either on streaming or physical. I mean, Lucas is something, he's rich enough to be a philanthropist. He's in that museum he just built in Los Angeles. So that may be part of this. I don't know. But again, you know, even beyond that, he had a huge life. There was a 1950s TV series starring Steve Holland, which was shot in Berlin, apparently. How bizarre is that? Steve Holland, we go back to the other month, then he was the Doc Savage cover model.
Paperbacks.
Yeah. He carried on in comic books. Then we get the 1980 iconic movie, which with Sam Jones, who also played the Spirit in a TV movie, and Max von Sydow is the villain.
Yes.
And Ornella Muti. Let's think about that. Let's all think about Ornella Muti.
What happened to her?
I really don't know. She had a wildly successful career in European film. I actually don't know. If anybody's interested, a great recent book by a guy called John Walsh about the making of that film.
Yeah.
And it rather fascinatingly includes a section on the film that it was going to be. You know, it was going to be directed by Nick Roeg originally.
Yes.
And it'd have been a wildly different film. Apparently, Keith Carradine would have been Flash and Debbie Harry would have been the princess.
Wow.
And the visuals are strange. But instead, the version we got is fantastic, the Mike Hodges version with music by Queen. And that, again, that has produced a very strong perception, I think, in the public conscience. I mean, that Sci-Fi did a TV series in 2008, which wasn't great. It got better as it went on, but... Interesting enough, I think it demonstrates the difficulties of trying to do these characters of their time. That clearly struggled by not having the advantage of kind of stereotyping a lot of the characters.
Yeah.
And sort of it almost trips itself up trying to, you know, get over those hurdles, really. The newspaper strip's still going. There's a great gem in here. I don't know if you've seen it, Darren. Filmation did a Flash Gordon TV series, cartoon series in the late 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
They also did, and I think there's some rights issues why you can't buy this, but you'll find it if you look around. Flash Gordon, The Greatest Adventure of All, which was a TV cartoon TV movie, which kicked it all off.
Right.
Absolutely terrific. And it puts Flash in at the beginning of Second World War II, which may sound a little bizarre, but works really well. Shame it's never been released properly on home media recently. Again, I'm sure if you look, there are copies around anyway. Comics, take your pick. You've got the, the newspaper strip was fantastic. The comics, you had people like Al Williamson, absolutely beautiful work. Wally Wood did a backup for some of the strips.
Yeah, I remember.
Plenty of publishers, including Charlton, for quite an extended period of time. My favourite, in the 80s, DC did an 8-part limited series by Dan Jurgens where he updated the whole concept.
Oh, I haven't read that.
It's worth seeking out. It's really interesting. Flash was supposed to be a polo player originally.
Yes.
In the original concept. In this one, he's a retired basketball player with a chain of sports shops in the
U.S. Right.
Now that's, but it, this this thing works. So it's a combination of modern and the traditional. And I think that's a real underrated gem.
Yeah. Other
people disagree. The rights then went to Marvel. They did a nice two-parter written by Mark Schultz of Xenozoic Tales fame and illustrated beautifully by Al Williamson. Oh boy, what a master he was.
Yes.
We've got the Dynamite series from Jeff Parker, which I confess I haven't read. And most lately we've had Mad Cave comics.
Right.
Written by Jeremy Adams, I think, who wrote a real favourite of mine, Batman Soul of the Dragon, the animated movie.
Right.
But I think I started to follow that, but unfortunately, once Diamond collapsed, there were distribution problems, so I need to go back and revisit that. But
yeah,
a perennial character. I don't think, he's a guy, it's a character, he'll never go away.
No, and again, I remember the movie was first released, the one in the 80s with Dan Jones. Sam Jones.
Yeah.
I knew that was right. I said, Dan Jones? No, Dan Jones is Star Trek Discovery. Jones?
That's
Sam Jones. And I remember the comparisons. Oh, it's ripping off Star Wars. It's and it's got a cheaper budget and the special effect. And it's like, no, you're missing the point. You are absolutely missing the point. Flash is the archetypal space hero with ray guns and rockets. And again, some great world building with Ming and his empire and whatever. And it's just like, just take your blinkers off. And I love Star Wars. Don't get me wrong. I love Star Wars. I absolutely adore it. But Star Wars fans, it didn't start with Star Wars. I'm sorry, guys.
Context. I was going to say, if you like that, the book by John Walsh, well worth seeking out. I mean, the production designer was a guy called, I think, Danilo Donati, who was Fellini's production designer.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Literally tried to recreate the Alex Raymond strip, which is why it looks so baroque and retro. Even then, it looked retro, didn't it? Even 1980, it looked retro.
Yeah, very metropolitan, but very Metropolis.
Yeah,
in terms of the sets,
and
I felt
a great film, and and one that will persist, I'm sure, for a long time. Yeah. But Flash will persist. We'll get there'll be another movie eventually, another TV series. I've no doubt somebody will read. He seems to stand up to reinterpretations, whereas some of the others don't.
Yeah, I think because I think of the hero of that kind of interplanetary romance space heroes. I think he is the most modern in terms of.
Yeah, I think so.
His kind of appeal and the everyman caught up in something that is extraordinary and rising to the challenge. I think that is that's the appeal. It's kind of like everyone can be a hero if they have.
Yeah,
the right.
I mean, it's that putting that and again, this is something that Sci-Fi Channel TV says, whether you like it or not, struggles. It gets the common man as a hero bit, but it struggles to push on.
Yeah.
And capture the atmosphere without the benefit of almost what you'd call stereotyping.
Yeah,
it's a valiant effort. It doesn't quite get there. But yeah, old Flash, lucky guy. Just like Buck, two ladies to choose from. Some guys have all the luck.
It seems to be a common theme, actually, doesn't it? There's always that dilemma.
Correct. Yeah. And why shouldn't it be? Yeah. It's more entertaining. It's more entertaining that way. Let's be honest. Yeah. But yeah, Flash, at the end of the day, he'll never. I suppose one thing we could to tie the two together, Buster Crabbe obviously played both characters, and rather memorably in one episode of the Buck Rogers TV series from the late 70s.
Yes.
Major Gordon.
Yes.
Who told Buck Rogers, "I've been doing this since you before you were born, Sonny."
Yeah. And he weren't kidding.
And he wasn't kidding, but you know, somebody knew their stuff to put him as a guest.
Yeah, that was that. I thought that was class, actually.
Yeah,
that
it
was
is.
Real. That was a real nod.
Yeah,
and I love it when TV series and films do that, where they know that it's only right to give what came before it a nod. And I think that's we're not getting enough of that these days.
Yeah, it was meta before meta was a word for these things.
So I think. We need to move on really to the sword and sorcery epic hero. And there's really only one template we can start with and probably finish with, to be fair.
Everything else, you're right. And everything else is derivative. Let's go. So again, everybody knows who he is, Conan.
Yeah.
The Barbarian, or you know, whichever description you wish to apply to him. Created by Robert E. Howard. Howard was an interesting character, born in 1906 and committed suicide in 1936. He was 30, 31 when he passed away. No real success in the writing field until he was 23. From Cross Plains, Texas. Apparently he was a bookish child in a very much a man's world of, you know, oil riggers and wildcats.
Yeah.
Barroom brawls, etc., etc. Probably struggling to find his place in the world. He was a boxing fan. He took up bodybuilding. I think there's some pictures of him where him and his buddies are brandishing swords, for fun, etc., etc. So I take that view. He felt out of place, and he created many characters and created stories in many genres, really. But the most memorable, obviously, of them is Conan. And surprisingly, there are only 21 stories, including one novel, which is The Hour of the Dragon, and there's various finished fragments. Now, if there's anybody out there, and it probably isn't, who hasn't read any of these things, you can buy them for pennies on an e-reader, because they're all in the, I guess those versions are in the public domain. But if you really want the best versions, there's a 3 paperback volume Del Rey set, which is still in print, which contains all the original texts and all the unfinished fragments, and some beautiful illustrations by people like Mark Schultz, Gregory Manchess, and I think John Watson might be the other one.
Yeah,
they're not particularly expensive, and if you like the character or you want to bone up on the character, then they're the ones to have, really. But I don't even know where you start or finish with this character. For me, Howard is. I know you agree with this. Howard is the greatest adventure fiction writer of all time. I don't think anybody's close.
He single-handedly created the genre. I think that's we all think that it's always been swords and sorcery. It wasn't. It was sword and sandals. He created this whole. There be monsters out there, and we need these heroes to battle those monsters.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're not really heroic. They are.
No,
they're gritty. They're violent. They're of their ilk.
And the thing with Conan is, he's, you know, call him a barbarian. He's from the northern wastes. He's less inverted commas civilized, close inverted commas, than the emerging world that's to the south. But it's his barbarian qualities that see him through: the bullheadedness, the directness, etc., etc. People say he's not, you know, he's unsympathetic. I don't think he is. I think if you really read him, try to understand the character, he uses his individual qualities to push himself through his adventures. Yeah. And some of those stories are perfect. I mean, Tower of the Elephant, Frost Giant's Daughter, to me, perfect short stories.
Yeah.
There isn't a wasted word. There isn't an excessive paragraph. There isn't anything that's missed out. Some of the longer stories, Queen of the Black Coast, is terrifically memorable, and attempts to show a side of Conan, and does it brilliantly that perhaps you don't suspect. Witch Shall Be Born, and the longer form story, something like Red Nails, is the perfect is the perfect Lost City story.
Yeah, I was going to say Red Nails is the one that absolutely blew me away when I read that.
Yeah,
as a kid.
But if you just want to sample it, and you never have for some reason, Tower of the Elephant, I don't think there's a better short story or short story. It's got a setup, it's got the adventure, it's got the payoff. Everything about it is satisfying. And it's totally imaginative. I mean, he did link his prose and his world into the likes of Clark Ashton Smith and H.P. Lovecraft, and we know they all responded. But never in a particularly overt way. I just think these are terrific. I mean, and most of them appeared after he died.
Yes. So, and the real success came after he died as well.
I mean, they really got thrust into the public eye in the 60s, where Lancer paperbacks republished them with those amazing Frank Frazetta covers. It was going to give you visual notation of what this world and the character looked like. It was those covers, just spectacular.
Yeah, and as much as Frank's covers sold Conan as well, we should say Conan sold Frank.
That was his
way into everything else.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that cover is called The Adventurer, where he stood on the top of the corpses with a girl clinging at his leg. It's amazing. I mean, the properties were kind of elaborated on for those books, because there's more books than stories by L. Sprague de Camp and Bjørn Nyborg, I think. I mean, make of that what you will. Some people hate the expansions and hate the stories that they've put in. As a teenager reading them, it didn't bother me at all. I knew that those weren't as good. I could work out even then those weren't quite as good as the Robert E. Howard story. And then, of course... Actually, Gil Kane tried to get the rights to the character to do an independent line of graphic novels in the late 60s and failed. Eventually, Marvel took him on, I think, 1970. Roy Thomas convinced Martin Goodman to pay a meager license fee to the estate or the properties or the rights holders. Yeah. He wanted John Buscema, but they couldn't afford John Buscema. His page rate was too high, so Roy Thomas got a fairly newbie artist who was British called Barry Smith.
Yes.
He wasn't called Barry Windsor Smith at that point. He obviously had with the royal family. And apparently the sales of that comic saved Marvel. Is that true? Have you heard
it? This is the strange thing about the history of Marvel at that time, because there were the two licenses that Star Wars definitely was a big savior.
Yeah.
That was a massive savior. And initially, Conan didn't sell very well.
Yes, right. It was cancelled at one point, wasn't it?
It was cancelled.
Like a week or a day or something, yeah.
Yeah, and then suddenly the sales figures that started to come in after Marvel had cancelled it as the issue. It was word of mouth, basically. Everyone saying how beautiful the book was, how different it was. And so the last couple of issues before they cancelled it, the sales had ramped up quite considerably, and that's what brought it back then, so they decided to continue. Whether it saved Marvel,
I've read that somewhere. I think
it probably established Marvel as someone who was willing to do different things.
And
I think that was something that they really made a lot of dollar on, the fact that as beautiful as those initial comics, color comics, were, the one that blew me away was the black and white Savage Sword of Conan. Those first 50 issues of that in particular are just beautiful.
Incredible. Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, the first 24 issues of the color comic by Barry Smith, you can actually see Barry Smith getting better issue by issue.
Yeah.
Until you get to a kind of almost Raphaelite type issue, 24, The Song of Red Sonja, which is just a work of art from start
to finish.
And then Buscema took it up when it was a success, and his work is incredible. Now, whether he's pushed on by what's come before, not that John Buscema, to my mind, ever needed to up his game, but there's some beautiful work by him.
Yeah.
But yeah, Savage Sword. I mean, if you just look at that first issue, there's a John Buscema story, there's a Red Sonja story by Neil Adams and Esteban Maroto, which is amazing. You know, they've done... I suppose we should mention, we mentioned Red Nails. You know, Red Nails to me is, the comic adaptation is as good as the novel.
Yeah.
Incredible. And if you can read it in the Marvel Treasury edition, which Barry Smith recolored himself,
yes,
it must be one of the only black and white comics that looks better in color.
Yeah.
It's absolutely sensational. Yeah. Obviously, both those magazines subsisted for an awful long time at Marvel, but they were eventually cancelled. Amazing body of work. And the rights went to Dark Horse. I don't know what you felt about that. I liked them initially, but by the end, I couldn't stand them.
They just became a typical sword and sorcery comic. There was no real... Yeah. And I think they failed to recognize they were actually being derivative of themselves, or rather than, I mean, it's all been done before, basically.
Yeah.
And they needed to try and take it in a different direction. And it almost became, to me, and it was the same with Sonya as well, when Marvel lost the rights to Sonya, which strikes me as really odd because they created the characters, an amalgam of two other characters. They became parodies almost.
Yeah. I would agree, yeah. I mean, they went from Dark Horse to Marvel for a short period of time, which some of those weren't bad, actually, and it brought Jim Zub to the table, who now writes it for Titan and Heroic Signatures, which is a good comic.
Yeah.
It's one of the only monthly series I bother to follow.
Right.
They seem to have managed to find a way to do traditional Conan in you know, a publishing world that perhaps doesn't welcome that kind of character anymore. But
no.
There's some quality stuff being done.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, suppose you mention other media. There's been a newspaper strip briefly by Roy Thomas and John Buscema originally. Didn't last too long. Obviously, the movies, Conan the Barbarian, which isn't really Robert E. Howard's Conan, but still a good film.
Yeah.
And it had the great Schwarzenegger basically looked like a John Buscema drawing.
He did. And the tree scene from, which was taken from...
There's elements in there. It's not really a Conan film, but it's still a good movie. Conan the Destroyer, I always think of. It's a lot of fun. It's the first Dungeons & Dragons movie to me.
Yeah, it is.
Eminently watchable.
It was almost like they went with Destroyer down the route of let's try and get kids involved. Let's try and get kids to the cinema.
Without a doubt, yeah. I mean, it's a shame we didn't see the original Roy Thomas and Jerry Conway script, which apparently was much better. There was a dreadful TV series in the 90s. Terrible. I don't even
know. No, I didn't see that, thankfully.
Another body, but they are awful. Awful in a way, if you've drunk too much late at night, you know. There was a really good cartoon series, I think, written by Christy Marks.
Oh, I haven't seen that either.
Yeah, that was in the 90s as well. So, and then there was the Jason Momoa film. Not great. He was a good Conan, though, I think. He was a good Conan, but not the best.
Yeah, it was more like a made-for-TV movie. I felt like it was a made-for-TV movie rather than a cinema release. I agree with you. I think he as Conan was good.
Yeah. I think he'd be better now as Conan, actually. Now he's a bit older. He would be a good Conan. But he's busy with other things, clearly. Everything to me, I mean, there's been plenty of pastiche. Obviously, we mentioned Sprague the Camp and Bjorn Nyborg. Many authors have written Conan books. Take your pick, really. There's been some recent releases in Titan and Heroic Signatures. To my mind, the one worth picking out, there's a two-story volume by a guy called John C. Hocking.
Yeah.
He is the closest thing, to my mind, you will get to Robert E. Howard. And that is a terrific book. But, of course, Robert E. Howard wasn't a one-trick pony. Plenty of other characters.
No, King Cole, Solomon. I loved Solomon Kane.
Yeah, King Cole preceded Conan, and in fact, I think the first Conan story, Phoenix on the Sword, is a rewrite of a Cole story. If I'm not mistaken. Solomon Kane is a great character, the Puritan adventurer.
Yeah,
that should have been a BBC TV series in the 1980s.
Yeah. I had to laugh because I've got this AI assistant that I asked to do a little bit of research, and what it came back with, she said, what you need to think about with Solomon Kane is it's Van Helsing meets Batman with a rapier. I think that's a great line.
Good description. That's actually great. But presumably, he didn't precede Van Helsing, clearly. He did. He preceded the Hugh Jackman.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good description. And then one of my big favourites, El Borak.
Oh, yes. I forgot about him.
Terrific adventure stories. And I suppose you mentioned those in particular, and Howard in general, was influenced by an author called Harold Lamb.
Yeah.
Who had stories about, he was a Cossack called Kalit. K-H-L-I-T. Careful how you pronounce, obviously.
Yeah.
Again, you can find them. They're good adventure stories. But El Borak, I think, is a terrific character. Why we've not seen more of him is beyond me. Clear influence on Indiana Jones, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And this is, and again, we're starting to actually pull out these forgotten heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But again, without them, these other heroes that everyone now knows, everyone knows Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Han Solo. And yet, without these heroes that we're talking about, they wouldn't exist.
No.
Or if they exist, they'd be different in some way. The DNA wouldn't gel, I don't think, as well.
I mean, today's popular culture stands on, as we said before, stands on the shoulders of giants. But, we should acknowledge how big those giants were.
Yeah. And I think this is why I love doing this series that we've done here, because we're dragging out these long forgotten characters. And even if just one person that listens to this podcast decides to go and try and buy one of the stories or one of the books, that's job done. And then that person, if you are that person that's listening right now, go and tell all your friends. Just say, this character is amazing. Go and check them out.
Read Robert E. Howard.
Yeah.
Because I can't see how you'd fail to be impressed. It's an incredible body of work by an incredible author.
I agree. And as I say, it's Solomon Kane. And I enjoyed the movie as well, actually. I thought movie was pretty good.
Yeah.
Again, another one that was just released without any fanfare, any kind of promotion. I didn't even know it existed until it popped up on TV one night.
No, I went to see it at the cinema. I actually got to see it.
I wish I'd have known.
Bizarrely, I remember looking at the side of it on the advert on the side of a bus as it went past in Tottenham Court Road.
Yeah.
And then I swear this is true. James Purefoy walked past me.
Wow.
As the bus was going past, and I later found out he was going to do a sign-in at the Big Forbidden Planet store.
Other comic shops do exist.
And other comic shops do exist. Thanks. But I probably did some strange double take, and he probably thought, who's that idiot? Which is not uncommon for me. But there we are.
No, I think there's a lot of... There's a huge wealth of fantastic stories to be and characters to be read by Howard, and we really recommend people do it.
Absolutely.
We've talked about a lot of the men, but we need to point out, we've already mentioned the incomparable J.J. Thoris, but there was another, even before Red Sonja was created by Marvel, there was another character created by C.L. Moore called Ural of Joyri, 1934.
Excellent, fantastic.
And she was not some damsel that needed rescuing. She wasn't a sidekick at all. She was always the protagonist in the stories that she featured in. She was violent and complex. A moral compass was very, shall we say, dependent on whether it suited her or not. It was that kind of character. Decades before.
Real challenging stuff. Howard did have his own female warrior, which was, they had two really. Obviously, you've got Red Sonja in the comics. Was not quite the Red Sonja of the books, which is, I think the story is it Sowers of Thunder? And it features a character called Red Sonja, S-O-N-Y-A, of Rogatine. I think she's fighting in the Siege of Istanbul.
Yeah.
But he's a pretty memorable character. And he also had a French character called Dark Agnes de Rastillon.
That's right.
Who featured in about three or four tales, which are pretty good. And again, she's very much the protagonist. I suspect, she could be very derivative of Jirel Juari, I guess. Again, fairly challenging stuff for the time, which most people won't acknowledge its existence. So.
Yeah. Well, it was my AI assistant Max that found out about this character and brought the character out. So I haven't had time to go and check into the character properly, but I certainly intend to do so, because I think it'll be interesting to see if we can get any of the stories linked from the post that we always do for these episodes. So I think what we're trying to say, guys and girls that are listening, is don't just stop with Marvel or with Star Wars. There's so much stuff before that that is really worth bringing back into the limelight today. Even if we couldn't really make anything out of them like a film or a comic book series today, because they don't, the very setting that they're in is what makes them work.
Yeah.
I think we still need to go and read them and acknowledge them. And you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs stories are always a good romp as well.
Yeah. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, they're interesting from a historical context, but they're also, there's a lot of good stuff here. I mean, you know, yeah, go and read Burroughs, go and read Robert E. Howard, go and read some of these guys, because it's really good. You know, it's good stuff. It's entertaining. Even if you want to debate, I mean, I've seen a load of debate online, for instance, I won't go into it now, about the Frost, you know, if you like, the morals of the Frost Giant's Daughter story. There's a ton of discourse about that online and on various forums. This is interesting stuff, and, you know, and as you say, it's not just a summer movie program.
No.
There's a huge heritage here. There's a huge history, which, I mean, even, don't just acknowledge it. Go and have a look at it, because it's interesting and it's quality.
It is. So in the final few seconds then, is there anything else you want to add on this episode?
Not really. Other than that, we call in the podcast Comics, Adventure in Comics International now, because you and I are in different parts of the world. So I think
we are.
Acknowledgement of the effort we put in here.
Different time zones. Windows updates.
Windows updates. So as you say, there's a fair bit gone into this one.
Yeah,
a few obstacles to overcome.
As usual, there's always a post that will go with this episode for people to comment in, and we'll try and get some of the artwork in that post as well. So people can see what we're talking about. And you're coming back for another one in Adventures of Comics about the good Captain, not Captain America.
Our boy, Captain Britain, Brian Braddock. Looking forward to that one.
That'll be good fun.
The old boy's 50 and he's looking good.
He is. So that'll be next time. So thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Darren.
And enjoy the sun where you are.
I will. Don't worry. I intend to.
All right. Thanks, mate. See you later.
Thank you for listening to ThinkWorks. Don't forget you can join in the conversation by visiting darreninform.com/community and finding the corresponding post for this episode. You've been listening to ThinkWorks, a podcast for thinkers.